I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. John and I today are going to be discussing some recent travels. We did that on our last podcast, and we've been traveling, so we've got more things to report. And I would also like to begin, though, by thanking some of our donors. We are doing our annual fundraiser, and we've had a number of new donations since our last podcast. I'd like to thank Kyle for $50, Sean for $300, somebody in Staffordshire for $25, John for $50, Randy for $20, Kelly for $100, Steve for $200, Jeff for $50, and Daniel for $2,000. And that comes to $2,795, which puts us at $5,496 so far. And our goal this year is to raise $70,000. So we're off to a very strong start. Thank you very much. Again, this is very important for you to step up and help out. We are especially concerned with rebuilding our monthly donors because we really took a setback in the aftermath of the Unite the Right rally when we were deplatformed from PayPal.
Thanks, everybody. You really help all of us, and we appreciate it.
Okay, so you made a really interesting trip recently to Ashotalam. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Ashotalam, yes.
Ashotalam. Ashotalam in Hungary to witness the founding of a new political party. And you've written about this on Countercurrents, but we have a whole different audience for podcasts and YouTube videos, so it's worth revisiting. So, John, tell us about your trip.
Well, I wanted to make sure to get down there for it because this is really the first major right-wing party that's been launched, well, really since Jobbik was, and that was in 2003 in Hungary. I should mention there's another party that was launched last year that in English is called Force and Determination. I don't really know exactly what they're up to right now. I haven't heard much about them lately. But I'm hoping to find out more. But I should just, as an aside, mention that there is this other party. But this party, just called Mi Hazánk, which means our homeland in Hungarian, it was very widely anticipated in Hungary because its founder, László Toroczkai, he's somebody who has been respected on the right in Hungary for about 20 years now. You know, he started out as a right-wing activist in his youth. He founded this organization, a metapolitical and cultural organization. It's called the 64 Counties Movement. That refers to all of the counties of Hungary before the Trianon Treaty of 1920, when it was about three times bigger than what it is now. And even today, there's still a lot of ethnic Hungarians living in these other regions, in Romania, in Slovakia, in all these neighboring countries, Ukraine. So the HVIM sought to represent all Hungarian youth, right-wing youth in these areas. He got a lot of respect for that, and he also, during the 2000s, started working closely with Jobbik. He was never actually an official member until 2 years ago, but he did work with them, and he was on some of their electoral lists, but he wasn't officially a member. He continued to work with HVIM until 2013, then he resigned from that, and shortly thereafter, he was elected the mayor of Ashotalam, where he was living. And he made quite a name for himself there because starting in late 2014, early 2015, it became the front line of what became known as the migrant crisis, because these migrants were flooding up through Greece. And then they would come up through the Balkans, and they would end up in Serbia. And then the first country that they would come to that was part of the Schengen zone, which is, it's technically part of the EU, but it's also different from the EU because there are EU countries that are in the Schengen zone and there are EU countries that are not in the Schengen zone. And there's also non-EU countries that are in this Schengen zone. Hungary is both in the EU and in the Schengen zone. And the migrants were coming across the border from Serbia into Hungary and then proceeding westwards, you know, through Austria and then up into wherever their final destination was, which was Germany or France or Sweden or wherever, wherever they thought they could get social benefits, of course. Laszlo was and is living in a farmhouse in Ashotelam that's right on the border with Serbia. And he had a real close-up view of what was going on because a lot of these migrants were cutting across his property at night. And he has three young daughters and a wife. And he said, you know, he was quite worried for their safety, seeing them coming across. I mean, we're talking about thousands of migrants, not just a handful. And this was happening every day. And he said he complained about it. But at first, the government was really hesitant to do anything about it because they saw it as more of a Western European problem. You know, they realized that the migrants weren't going to stay in Hungary. They were all trying to go further westwards. So at first they weren't sure, you know, what they wanted to do about it, if anything. They thought maybe they could be like Greece or Serbia, just let them go through. But Laszlo started to post photos and videos of what was happening to social media. And this started to attract a lot of attention in Hungary. And by the summer of 2015, there was really a popular outcry in Hungary to do something. And the ruling Fidesz party of Viktor Orban, they realized that, you know, this could be a winning issue for them. And I also would like to think that they recognized that this was a problem that they had to deal with. I would like to think it wasn't just a cynical move. I imagine there's some genuine concern there. So they decided to endorse Laszlo's solution to the problem, which was to build a fence along the border with Serbia to keep the migrants out. In fact, it's actually built so that it's 10 meters inside Hungary so that when the migrants come up, even to this day, they can be kept on the other side of the fence and turned away, but technically, you know, they're still on Hungarian territory. So that was a very clever move of Laszlo's to keep them out. He also developed his own security force, which to this day patrols the fence and makes sure that, you know, if anybody manages to cut through it or otherwise bypasses it somehow, there are actually these patrolmen whose job it is to track them down and catch them. So this was extremely effective. The fence was completed in September of 2015, and it really just stopped the migrant flow completely. People might remember that around August and early September of that year, there were a lot of media covering the fact that there were thousands of these migrants at Keleti station in Budapest who were trying to go to Austria, and the government and Orban would not let them through. Finally, when the fence was completed and the parliament passed a series of new laws to support it, such as, you know, making damaging the fence a criminal offense, they finally let because Merkel actually asked to receive them, they ended up sending the migrants that were left through, and then that basically put an end to the migrant problem in Hungary. There were still a couple of camps left over from before these new laws went into effect, but there were no new migrants coming into the country. And that was really a great feat. And when people tell me, you know, people on the left or otherwise who tell me that a fence with Mexico would never work in America, I always just say, well, I saw with my own eyes that it works in Hungary. So there is a precedent for this sort of thing. And Laszlo was the one who first suggested this idea. So he already was somebody who was quite respected on the right, but this really made him sort of a hero in Hungary. And he built on that. And by 2016, Jobbik, which I'm sure most listeners know what, at least at that time, was the party that was further to the right than Fidesz even, they wanted to select some new leaders and essentially reinvent themselves in order to prepare for the election that was held in April of this year. And their unfortunate strategy that they came up with for this was to basically try to moderate and soften their message. They'd always been thought of as a staunch radical right-wing party with very clear pro-Hungarian and anti-non-Hungarian views. So they developed this strategy, which was basically they wanted to link up the radical right, basically their existing base, with the liberals, mainly the Budapest liberals of Hungary, who hated Orbán. And their new strategy was to essentially become the party for anybody who disliked Orbán. And they basically dispensed with all of the rhetoric and most of the principles that they'd held up to that time. I was told by a number of their supporters back then that, well, you know, they have this new strategy, but their essential principles haven't changed. I don't actually think that's true for reasons that I'll go into. But anyway, in the spring of 2015, they expelled a number of leaders who were thought as being part of the old Jobbik, people who had the sort of rhetoric that they did not want in the new campaign strategy that they were developing. So there were a lot of vacancies, and they ended up putting in a lot of more liberal-leaning people in the top positions in Jobbik. But one exception to that was that they ended up voting Toretskay to be the vice president of Jobbik. And this was kind of seen, well, I think it had significance in two ways. One was it was sort of an offering to placate the right-wing base of Jobbik. They thought, well, if people respect Toretskay, if he's there, that will show that we're not completely, abandoning the right, since people knew that he was somebody who was staunch and reliable. The other reason, I think, is that they wanted to cash in on the fame that he'd gotten by coming up with the idea for the border fence. I think that was also one of the factors that went into their decision. And he accepted it. He served as the vice president, but, from 2016 up until now, Jobbik has basically been drifting further and further leftwards. And, we saw this manifested in things like they were constantly attacking Orbán for supposed corruption and talking about the Orbán dictatorship, that there was no democracy in Hungary, which is exactly the same tactics that the left had been using in Hungary, except with less success. I should mention, for those who don't know, Jobbik since 2010 has been the main opposition party in Hungary. The left has been virtually dead in Hungary. They have very little political clout. Jobbik was the only party that was able to mount a serious challenge to Fidesz. Even now, they control about 20% of the parliament. This was significant, this change in direction. There were things like Gábor Vona, who was the leader of the party. He was sending Hanukkah greetings to the Jewish leaders of Hungary, which were rejected, ironically. This was quite surprising for a party that had been seen as strongly Judeo-skeptic, we could say, prior to that time. But there were just a whole host of examples of ways in which they changed their rhetoric. And Laszlo, to his credit, counter-signaled a lot of these initiatives. He didn't leave the party. He stayed with it. But he made known his objections to the direction that it was going in. And when the election finally came in April of this year, as everyone knows, I mean, Orbán won a landslide victory. He was predicted, everyone knew he would win, but it was predicted that he would at least lose some seats in parliament, to the left or to Jobbik. They did not. They actually held their own entirely, and they even were able to manage to retain their supermajority in the parliament, which means that's, if you have 2/3 of the parliament, you can modify the constitution without having to consult with anybody else. They actually managed to achieve that again. Jobbik held its own as well. They even managed to pick up 3 seats in parliament. They went from 23 to 26. But they fell far short of their objective, which was to, win the election, of course. And they even managed to fail to deny Fidesz their supermajority. So basically, they went through all that rigmarole to exchange their original right-wing base, which had largely abandoned them by the time of the election, and replaced it with these liberal voters who hate Orbán, and saw It was a completely cynical move, both by their new supporters and by the party, because they basically thought that, well, if we make this change, we can, you know, okay, we think that Jobbik were bastards in the past, but, they're the best chance we have of getting rid of Orban, so we'll overlook all of that and support them. But it didn't work. I mean, there's maybe 10% of the Hungarian population that thinks of itself as being liberal in the Western sense. So sure, they held their own, but they did not achieve their objectives. It was already rumored before the election was held that László was considering starting a new party, that would be further to the right of Jobbik again. After the election, Gábor Vona did as he promised and he resigned as the leader of Jobbik. He'd been the leader for 12 years. He stepped down. So they had to hold an election within the party to decide who the new leader would be. And, it was, Toretskij and another gentleman by the name of Schneider. Schneider, interestingly, was a skinhead in his youth, but these days he's very closely identified with the new liberal line that Jobbik has taken. The election was held and László ended up getting over 46 or maybe 47%. I can't remember precisely, but, 46 to 47% of the votes. He lost to Schneider, unfortunately. But, when this happened, he basically went back to the party and said, look, I represent nearly half of the membership, obviously, as we can see in the election results. And he presented the party with a list of principles and basically gave them an ultimatum. And he said, you have 1 month to adopt these principles as part of the program of Jobbik, or there's going to be a split in the party. And the principles were things like taking a strong stand on immigration, because since the election, Jobbik had been doing things like marching alongside the leftist parties and alongside these NGOs that have been trying to cause problems for Orban and unseat him. So Jobbik basically showed that it was willing to work with Soros-supported parties and organizations in order to try to bolster its own popularity. László wanted to basically take the party back to its roots, make it, you know, explicitly nationalistic, explicitly against immigration, explicitly concerned with the gypsy problem, and so forth. Needless to say, the leadership did not take kindly to being given an ultimatum, and he was expelled from the party shortly thereafter that. And there were a couple of other people among the Jobbik leadership who joined him. Dora Duro, she's a woman who actually is currently serving in the Hungarian parliament. She's also viewed as being part of the sort of the last vestiges of the Jobbik right. She actually resigned to go with László. And her husband had already been effectively expelled from the leadership of the party 2 years ago. His name is Novak. But he actually went with them as well. So they announced that last Saturday they would announce the birth of this new party, Mi Hozank, again, our homeland. And I knew I had to be there. I mean, this could – it's unclear exactly what the results of it are going to be. But this is clearly a step in the right direction, because Jobbik has essentially abandoned – the principles that it originally had, and has it now, at best, we could call it a liberal conservative party, I would say. And this is a problem, because even though they weren't governing the country, they were having a very positive impact on Hungary, in that because they were the main opposition party, they were always forcing Fidesz to go further to the right. And in fact, to try to head off Jobbik's popularity over the last 8 years, Fidesz has ended up adopting a lot of the ideas that Jobbik first proposed in their original manifesto. So they were having a good impact on the country and then decided to do a 180 on that. So if this new Mi Hozank party can fill those shoes and play that role, that will be great. It remains to be seen if they'll actually be able to pull that off. But I did see a survey recently which showed that the most popular Jobbik politicians the most well-known Jobbik politicians besides Vona are Todetsky, Dura, and Novak. So they basically have three of the, you know, big heavyweight names in Hungarian politics with this party right out of the gate, and they're bringing a lot of experience to this thing. So I think that there's a very good possibility that they could develop into something significant.
Great. So what are some of the principles of the new party? Could you just sort of give us an outline of what they stand for and how they differ from Jobbik and also from Fidesz?
Well, I had the opportunity to interview Laszlo on Saturday after mm-hmm. the event. And you can read it on the Countercurrent site. I transcribed the interview. But he wouldn't really get too much into specifics because they haven't even developed a program yet. I mean, he was expelled from Jobbik less than a month ago. So
right.
they're still, he told me that over the next few months they would be developing their program. But I'm assuming that based on what he's been saying in interviews and also based on this, set of principles that he wanted Jobbik to adopt, we have some idea. And one of them is that, you know, he wants to do something about the flood of Hungary skilled workers westwards to the Western mm-hmm. European countries because, you know, that's having a very bad effect on the Hungarian economy. Skilled workers, I think the last report I saw said that there's 800,000 Hungarian workers living in the Western EU. And in a country of 10 million people, that's pretty significant, and that's not good for Hungary. I mean, you can't really blame them for going there because they're going in pursuit of higher wages. But,
right.
you know, Laszlo thinks there's more the government can do to try to persuade these people to come home.
As a legacy of communism, does the state own a lot of property, farms, apartments, houses, and things? Have all those things been privatized?
I know a lot of it has been privatized. I think they still do own some.
Yeah, if they had held on to that, that could be a really good way of incentivizing people to stay, because you can say to a Hungarian doctor, look, we can't pay you what you'd get working in London, but you can live in Hungary, and here's a nice villa, mm-hmm. right, where you can raise your family. And so by providing things like that, that objectively give people a higher standard of living, even though they might not be getting the same wages as they would in the West, that could counterbalance this brain drain that Hungarians are dealing with. And you could do that not only with people who are going abroad to be doctors, but people who are going abroad to be waiters. There are a lot of people I met in London who were basically waiting tables, who were from the Baltic states and Hungary. And also Poland, and also construction workers too. And I'm thinking maybe something like that could be an incentive for these people to stay and start families. Because when you have young people going abroad, especially, that's not good, because that's when they should be finding people of their own age from their own country and settling down and starting families, not
yes.
drifting around chasing dollars in Dublin or London or Paris or something like that.
Yeah, that's very true. I know that one of the things they want to do is to offer taxation incentives for these mm-hmm. people, but I don't know. There's a lot of things they could possibly do, but besides that, I know, you know, Laszlo doesn't like the fact that, Jobbik used to talk about the gypsy problem, but they don't really anymore. And he claims that Fidesz doesn't address it enough. So he wants to be more explicit about that. He wants to do more to help the ethnic Hungarians who are living in the neighboring countries of Hungary. And of course he wants to remain very firm on the immigration issue, although already, of course, you know, Fidesz is doing quite well in that regard, although I guess you could go even further and actually block immigration from non-EU countries altogether. He didn't tell me that's his intention, but I was thinking that's one direction he could go in with it.
Right. So let me ask you, one of the things that was kind of bizarre about Jobbik and actually led them to make very dumb statements about Turkey and the EU was the presence of this Turanist ideology, this sort of linguistic nationalism that basically said that because Hungarians speak a language that's related to Asian languages, including Turkic, that they somehow are part of some great family of Turanic peoples. And I remember Gabrovona making some statement based on Turanism about, say, Turkey's admission to the EU or trade with Turkey, things like that. And I thought, wow, that's a very strange and dangerous dangerous conclusion drawn from a kind of LARPy 19th century ideology. Is the new party going to be Turanist in any way?
Well, I should say that this is a big idea in Hungary. I mean, a lot of people adhere to it, even ordinary people. So it's not, you know, some fringe idea in Hungary. I mean, not everybody does by any means.
Right.
But I've met even just ordinary Hungarians who, you know, will say, oh, we're all sons of Attila, things like that. And it goes way back. I mean, the Arrow Cross Party, which was the fascist party of Hungary in the 1930s and 1940s. I mean, Turanism was their official ideology.
Right.
So it's not something that Jobbik adopted on its own. In fact, Fidesz has it too. Orban invoked it. It was either in 2011 or 2012, but Orban actually came out in favor of admitting Turkey to the EU.
Right.
And he used this Turanist rhetoric as part of it. I don't think he would do that today.
No.
This was, you know, 6 or 7 years ago now, but he has invoked it. So it's not, I just want to make it clear. This isn't something that's unique to Jobbik. This is a Hungarian thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I've certainly met plenty of Hungarians who do not embrace it. So I guess you could say it's a split in society. It's not, I don't think, you know, ordinary Hungarians are sitting around talking about Turanism one way or the other. I mean, they want parties that are going to address things in their everyday lives that are important. You know, these sort of theoretical things, I think, are much less important to them. But anyway, all that being said, I did ask Laszlo about this, not as part of the interview that I did at Countercurrents, but just privately. And yes, he did say that he's not interested in having that as part of the new platform. So no, you're not going to see any of that in Miholzank. I'll also mention that he didn't also like the fact that, you know, Vona, he also kind of dropped this the last couple of years, but you know, he was also known for being very friendly towards Islam,
right?
Which I think stemmed from his adherence to traditionalism. But I also know that Laszlo didn't like that very much, so I don't think you're going to be seeing that either in the new party. I think he wants to be focused on Hungarian needs and Hungarian ideas, and not so much, you know, these sort of stranger historical/religious/metaphysical idea. You know, I don't think you're going to see so much of that in this party.
Right. That's interesting. In Hungary, is there a substantial or appreciable number of people who are, say, interested in monarchism and so forth? I see the crown of Saint Stephen is on their coat of arms, and it's displayed in the parliament, and these things are definitely part of their history, but are there any bona fide actual monarchists in Hungary today?
Oh, lots.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's... Okay, let me qualify that by saying that I don't think that you're going to be seeing monarchism proposed as you know, a solution to, you know, as an alternative to the present Hungarian system anytime soon.
Right.
But there are certainly, I've met a substantial number of people on the right who have this idea, especially among the traditionalists, but not only among
mm-hmm.
The traditionalists. I mean, you know, people who follow Évola and Gerhard.
Right.
In fact, there's one organization that I've been thinking about profiling for Countercurrents, because I know some of the leaders of it. So maybe down the road, I might do an article on that.
Yeah, that's sort of an aside. I was just curious about it, and I thought I would ask you.
Well, that there is a connection to Laszlo, because this 64 counties movement that he used to run, and which is still around, actually, even though he's not part of it anymore, was very explicitly pro-monarchist when he was in it. So I haven't... Maybe that's for a future interview I could have with him. I could ask him if he still believes in that.
Yeah, yeah, that would be interesting. It could be something that emerges as part of the new party's ideology or platform, or at least something that they make reference to. So yeah, that's something to keep a watch on.
The problem, of course, with that, as I've discussed with some Hungarians, is who the monarch would be.
Right.
Because, of course, for a long time, and the last monarchs of Hungary were the Habsburgs. And if you look at the Habsburg dynasty today, they're not really people you would want running a country that wants to embrace right-wing ideas. So
Right, exactly.
You'd have to come up with some other solution if you wanted to.
Well, Hungary did have a very interesting interwar institution of the regent, namely Admiral Horthy. Horthy basically set himself up as the regent of the King of Hungary, but he outlawed the last Habsburg from returning to the country. And he maintained the rituals and calendar, I understand, of the Habsburg court during his time as regent of Hungary. And he was in power for basically more than two decades, as I recall. It would be interesting if Hungary adopted a kind of new, unique form of monarchism, a monarchy without a monarch, just the sort of regency principle, which I thought was kind of fascinating.
It's a possibility down the road. I don't think it's something you're going to see in the near future in Hungarian politics, but in the long term, who knows? It's certainly still something that's part of the Hungarian consciousness.
It is interesting how romantic a lot of Hungarians are in their conception of the world and themselves, where, you know, monarchism is something that's still a live option, and they look back on their history and they remember the great kings of the past with affection. A few years ago, when I was in Vienna, I was given a tour of the Habsburg crypts. And when we got to the tomb of Sisi, the Empress Elizabeth, there were a number of wreaths that had been laid on at her tomb in the Hungarian national colors. Obviously, Hungarians had come to her crypt and laid wreaths there because they had a fond relationship and fond memories of that particular Habsburg empress. So I thought that was kind of touching.
Yeah, absolutely. You see the same kind of thing in Hungary, although it's a bit more complicated because I don't know if I'd say the most important, but one of the most important holidays in Hungary is March 15th, which is the anniversary of the date that Hungary entered the 1848 revolution.
Right.
Which, of course, was against the Habsburgs. And the interesting thing is, you know, among my nationalist friends, there's a great deal of division over that. I mean, there's some nationalists who embrace it as this heroic struggle of Hungary against tyranny, and that's certainly the official line, you know, that the state takes on it. But I also, you know, especially among these monarchists and traditionalists who I know in Hungary, they'll tell you that, you know, they think it was an absurd revolution, because they'll say, well, you know, they were revolting against the proper monarch of Hungary, and they didn't really have a plan for what they wanted in the aftermath. And it's interesting because when March 15th comes, you know, I'll go to the official ceremony that the government holds, and then usually some of my friends will hold the anti-March 15th, where we'll go and drink a beer somewhere, and they refuse to join in the festivities,
right,
marking the occasion. So, yeah, there's kind of two ways of looking at that on the right in Hungary.
Interesting. So are there any other things that come to mind about your visit to the founding of this party?
Well, I if anybody happens to come to Hungary and they want to see the border fence, you should get in touch with Laszlo, because he's more than willing to take people there and show them around. And it is quite interesting. I mean, he'll explain how he came up with the idea and how they ended up setting it up. And, you know, a lot of thought really went into making sure that, you know, it would actually keep people out. And the town itself, I mean, it's slightly under 4,000 inhabitants, so it's quite small, but it's quite nice. And Laszlo even, you know, last year he tried to enact laws that criminalized public displays of Islam and public displays of homosexuality in the town, but the Hungarian courts struck them down, unfortunately. But he hasn't given up on the idea of sort of keeping it as a, you know, even if the rest of, not that this is happening, but if the rest of Hungary were to turn back towards liberalism, I know he's quite prepared to turn Ashotelem into kind of a shelter of sorts.
Right, right.
But it's a very nice town. I mean, it's where the event was held was sort of out in the countryside, with green trees, and it was a nice day, and the whole thing was quite pleasant. And I didn't get an opportunity to talk to them, but I did see Dora Duro and her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And they're clearly quite as charismatic as he is. And they, all of them, I mean, they were besieged by people wanting autographs and wanting to take photos with them for a good 3 or 4 hours after the ceremony ended,
mm-hmm.
Which is why I was very grateful that he took the time to talk to me, because that was in the middle of when all this was going on. But, it's obvious there's a lot of excitement about this on the right, so I hope that they get some momentum going from this.
Yeah, as we talked about before in a recent podcast where we talked about how Jobbik had mainstreamed itself and abandoned its principles, I do think that it's important, even if you are a supporter of Orban and Fidesz. And it's hard not to support Orban because he's doing such a good job of things and he is such a competent and charismatic politician. It's still good to have the right kind of opposition, because what Orban has done is taken ideas from Jobbik when it was more principled and more on the right and adopted them and enacted them. And having a rightist party as a kind of metapolitical counterweight to all these forces that drag practical politicians towards the center is a really important thing to have. Even if you are happy with the job that Orban and Fidesz are doing and you wouldn't, you know, countenance a different prime minister at all, it's good to have the right kind of opposition, because all the forces in modernity, especially outside of Hungary, are pushing or pulling or sucking or whatever towards the center and the left, right? There are all these pressures to move to the center and then, of course, traverse the center and go to the left. And if you've got a vital rightist opposition, a vital principled rightist opposition as part of your culture, as well as part of your political spectrum, it just provides a counterweight. And I think that this is what's most hopeful for me about this new party. Orban will flourish and keep doing the good stuff that he's doing, and there will be something that will keep that party from being pulled towards the center by forces within Hungary and forces impressing themselves upon Hungary from outside.
Well, it's pretty amazing that we have a country in Europe today that where the, you know, the two primary alternatives, the only meaningful ones, are the right and the far right. I mean, that's quite remarkable when you think about it.
That's pluralism that I could live with. Exactly.
But even beyond that, I mean, the fact is, I mean, you know, Orban, I think he's certainly got, quite a few years left in him, but he's not going to be around forever. And Laszlo's, you know, a good 25, 30 years younger than him. So, you know, who knows? Down the road, maybe he'd be in a position to, you know, continue the legacy or even take it further. I hesitate to get too excited, because when I first came to Hungary in 2014, I got really excited about Jobbik and I went around telling everybody that, oh, they're the real deal. You know, this is the real right wing party. And then, you know, 2 years later, they just completely cucked out. Or started to. So I feel like I should be more careful about doing that a second time. But I really do feel like Laszlo is quite serious. I mean, if you look at his record of activism, it's really quite clear how serious he is and how uncompromising he is. So, and when I saw him on Saturday, I mean, it was, his enthusiasm was infectious. I mean, he was smiling, he had this huge smile on his face, and he was obviously really excited to be finally making this happen. Yeah, I'm sure it's an idea he's had at the back of his head, you know, probably for years. It was just very, reassuring to see how excited he was and how energetic he was. And I really think, you know, something will happen. I can't say exactly what. Maybe in 3 years, well, 4 years when the next election is, maybe they'll be the ones to get 20% of the parliament. Who knows?
So one last thing I wanted to ask about this new party is, what are their attitudes towards Hungarian nationalism in relationship to broader European identity? Because a lot of people worry about nationalist parties. They think, well, you know, you can get myopically nationalist or nationalist in a petty way and lose track of our broader brotherhood with other European peoples. And I have to say that my feeling in Hungary is that Hungarians do both really well, that they can be very patriotic and very committed to being part of a larger European culture. So what are the attitudes in this new party about that issue?
Well, if you read the interview that I did with Laszlo, I mean, he actually explicitly says that he thinks of himself as Hungarian first, but a European second. And he talks right. about how, you know, there needs to be a European Union, just, you know, a different sort of European Union from the one that we have now.
Right.
Different priorities. So it's clearly on his mind, and people have told me that he's always been a staunch pro-European. But it is a thorny issue in Hungary because, you know, unlike the Western European states, there's still a lot of conflict between Hungary and its neighbors. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, in Romania, you know, they've actually threatened to execute leaders of the Hungarian community for, you know, this is just, you know, in recent months.
Yeah,
for nationalist activism. Then, you know, Ukraine passed this language law, and you know, has otherwise, you know, been threatening and harassing the minority communities, which includes the Hungarians in Ukraine. So, I mean, these are still very real issues, and they're not just going to go away. But I'll have to do an interview with Laszlo a few months down the road, another one.
Right.
And ask him about some of the things we're talking about, because that wasn't a question I asked him, although that would have been a good one. But if I go back to how Jobbik was talking when I first came to Hungary 4 years ago, you know, what they told me was that, well, you know, you will of course meet nationalists who dream of restoring Greater Hungary and, you know, reconquering all of them, but they're very much in the minority, and I don't think that's common Hungarian sentiment. They don't have any way to realize it anyway, militarily or any other way. But they do think that in the areas where Hungarians are the majority, in parts of Transylvania and elsewhere, that through the EU, they could democratically attain autonomy for these regions.
Right.
And I a couple of months ago, I took a trip to Serbia. I was in Subotica for a couple of days. Subotica was a Hungarian town. It was in Hungary until Trianon in 1920. And it was very interesting to see a contrasting approach to how some of the other countries handled it, because when they got this territory from Hungary in 1920, they didn't just go in and say, well, you're all going to speak Serbian now, and, you know, we're going to, you know, take down all the evidence of the Hungarian language and Hungarian culture. They actually gave the region a large degree of autonomy, and that's why even now, 98 years later, they still have street signs in Hungarian, other signs in Hungarian. There's, you know, statues to Hungarian writers and artists in the town, alongside, Serb ones. So Yugoslavia, I think, at that time in the 1920s, took a very rational approach that I think has borne fruit. I mean, nobody's talking about, as far as I know anyway, intercommunal clashes between Serbians and Hungarians. So it seems to me like they, handled it much better than what you see in places like Ukraine and Romania.
Right.
So I think there is a way forward there, and I'll ask Laszlo about this the next time I interview him, but I suspect that's something what he'll say, is that through peaceful means it should be possible to attain greater autonomy for these regions.
Right. What is his attitude, if any, towards the V4 group, and maybe more broadly the Intermarium idea, which some people are now envisioning as something that could crystallize around the center of the V4.
I haven't asked him or talked to him about the Intermarium idea, but that he's, again, in the interview that I made, he made very positive reference to the V4.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all Hungarian nationalists are very positive about it. I mean, it's really, it started out as something that really didn't have much significance, but in recent years, it's sort of become a rallying point for the Eastern European countries that, you know, want to resist the EU, especially over the issue of immigration. I mean, just today, there was a meeting of the V4 at which Sebastian Kurz was in attendance. And they're talking about, you know, forming this sort of anti-immigration axis.
It's amazing the word axis is coming back into vogue.
Well, that's my word, I should
well,
say.
But, but there was I think Kurz actually used the term, though, talking about Italy, Austria, and Germany forming an anti-immigration axis. And I thought that was very interesting.
Yes, indeed. No, yeah, that looks like it remains to be seen how it's going to develop, but it's certainly very positive right now. And one of the more interesting things in the interview that I did with Laszlo that he mentioned was that his idea of how to reform the EU in a positive direction would be to admit more Eastern European countries.
Yeah, which ones in Eastern Europe aren't in the EU yet?
Well, Serbia is not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one he named explicitly. There are some countries that are in but aren't in the Schengen zone, like Croatia and Romania.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, obviously Ukraine isn't, but they're not going to be anytime soon,
right?
Because of the war. But he mentioned, you know, the idea that all of these countries share one thing in common, which is that they're very staunchly conservative.
Right.
So the more of them that there are in the EU, the more pushback there's going to be over these kind of liberal dictatorial policies.
Right.
And, I think that's a very good idea. I don't know what ability Hungary will have to make that happen, but, it's certainly a good idea.
Right. Well, excellent. Well, this is something to keep an eye on, and I very much look forward to your follow-up interview a few months down the road. I think we should already just count on that, and you should probably try and schedule it, because I have a feeling that this guy is going to be very, very busy creating this new party. So it's definitely something to watch with hope.
Absolutely, and I'll certainly keep an eye on it.
Well, I haven't had quite such a exciting trip, but this past weekend I was in San Francisco. In 2010, for the 50th anniversary of the death of Francis Parker Yockey in the San Francisco jail, we had a dinner, a Francis Parker Yockey memorial dinner. And it is a tradition we've kept going for 9 years now. So this was our 9th Francis Parker Yockey memorial dinner. We try and do it in June, but sometimes it's happened as late as August, just because, well, I don't live there, and so sometimes it's difficult to get back there and to schedule it in. There have been a few times when it's just been a small gathering, just a few people have gotten together, and other times where it's been much larger. We had a medium-sized one. We had 11 people in a very nice restaurant and got to meet some new people, and also saw a bunch of old friends, including a number of them who were at the very first dinner 9 years ago. So that was a really very positive experience, and it's nice to keep some things going. So, you know, 9 years is a good run for something like this.
Were there any talks?
No, there really weren't, because it wasn't the kind of atmosphere that was conducive to a talk, but it was a nice round table, and so we'd had lots of conversations, and everyone sort of participated in the conversations. And then there were some side conversations too, and then it was quite a positive experience, but no speechifying, not at this one. Some of them have had talks, and others have just been dinners with a small number of friends. So, but it's a tradition to keep going.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so let's do a little bit of shop talk, just to update people about what's happening at Countercurrents. And the first thing we should talk about is some more updates and discoveries connected with the Yaki edition. There were a couple of pieces that we were afraid we would have to go to press with in an incomplete form, his China essay, and also this essay from the National Renaissance Bulletin. But I understand there's been some progress on the China essay, so fill us in on that.
Well, just a couple of days ago, I got an email from a very generous contributor, I guess we could say, who actually has a copy of the complete manuscript. So I'm currently talking to him to get a copy of that. And it's unclear yet. He might have some other material that we might be able to use, although I don't want to get into specifics yet because we're still discussing that. But there might be other things as well. But we do at least, we will soon have the complete text of the China essay that I mentioned before. So really the only thing left, I was able to get that missing paragraph from, his, essay called 1848, 1948 Years of Decision.
Mm-hmm.
We got that, the missing paragraph from that. The only thing that remains is there's a couple of pages, from an essay that he wrote, we think under the name of, Frederick Weiss in the National Renaissance Party Bulletin. For 1953. It was published in four parts, and it's called Brotherhood. In the FBI files on Yaki, we found most of the pages of this essay, but there are two pages missing from two different issues. And I've been trying to get a hold of copies of these from libraries, because there are a few libraries that have these issues, but so far I haven't gotten it. So if anyone has issues of the National Renaissance Party Bulletin from 1953, and you'd be willing to share copies of these pages, please get in touch with me, you know, either in the comments here or in my email address on the site, because it would it might save me some time trying to get these from a library, and it would really be great to be able to include the complete text of the essay.
Yes, indeed. I'm really hoping that more issues of his newsletter, Front Fighter, will eventually come to light, but we're not going to delay publication looking for those, because that could be an endless task.
No, we'll have a revised edition down the road.
Yeah, I think that's really the way to handle it. Who knows, maybe there'll be a complete set of Front Fighters that will somehow come to light. But that is, it's so frustrating to see how time has been so unkind to Yaki, how much has disappeared, how much has been destroyed. And we're trying to wrest things from the teeth of time, in one case literally from the teeth of rats who had chewed away a paragraph from one of the pieces that we were trying to publish, and we have restored that missing paragraph, so that's very good. So I'm really excited that this is finally coming to a conclusion, and we're going to put this book to press in June without fail, and people should be getting their copies. The paperback should be available late in June. And
maybe we should say July, because it's already
oh my gosh, July. Yeah, it's practically the end of June. I apologize, I meant to say July. So yeah, we'll put this to press in July. Paperbacks should be available in July, and the hardcover limited editions will probably ship out around the beginning of August. So that's the plan, and we're very, very excited to complete this marathon project. And I'm already looking forward to our new edition of Imperium, which will be the next volume in this edition. There are going to be three volumes. The first volume is Imperium. The second volume is The Enemy of Europe. And the third volume will be the World in Flames. And we're going to be doing The World in Flames first, then Imperium, then The Enemy of Europe. And then probably down the road, there'll be either a revised edition of The World in Flames with additional stuff that comes to light. Or who knows, maybe there'll be a motherload of undiscovered stuff and we'll have to put out yet a fourth volume. That would be really exciting. So we are hoping to continue the Yaki edition, and the quest for the lost Yaki papers. And if anybody out there has a Indiana Jones cast of mind and wants to try and unearth some of these things from archives and so forth in private collections, it would be great if you would contact us. We would love to hear from you.
Or even if, I mean, there's people who were involved with Mosley's union movement, who probably would have had access to Yockey's, a lot of Yockey's material, things like, or the National Renaissance Party. Anyone who's in touch with people who may have been involved with those, you know, those people might have something that we could use.
Yeah. And it would be very, very good to start recording the recollections of some of these people. Some of these people are getting up there, and history needs to hear from them. History needs to hear their stories so we can put things together in the future. Because if we win, we will want to have an understanding of all the different tributaries that have gone into this particular current of thought. So the establishment wants to condemn all of this to basically oblivion, and we are working against that. The greater task is to keep our whole race from going into oblivion, but we want to keep our history from being lost too. That's part of the struggle. So the next project that's going to press, and it's going to press very, very soon, we're just wrapping up the final editing and putting the index together, is a book called The Alternative Right. It's an anthology that I have edited, and it consists of 35, maybe 36 essays on the topic of the alt-right or alternative right. And most of these pieces were originally published at Countercurrents. Some were published at other blogs and zines. But they deal with this phenomenon in terms of what it is and what it isn't, how it relates to other currents of thought, how it relates to certain issues, and it, basically its rise and fall. And there are a number of very important contributors to the volume. Jared Taylor, Kevin McDonald, Gregory Hood all have pieces in it. Aidan Cassiel has a couple of very good pieces. There are a couple pieces by James Lawrence, who writes primarily for Alternative Right at Blogspot, now Affirmative Right, that are very, very good. Other writers who are involved are Countercurrents writers like Emile Durand. Lawrence Murray has a couple of pieces in there from his now disappeared blog, The Atlantic Centurion. I have a few pieces as well. And John, you have a piece in there too about the alt-right and the new right.
Yeah, I hesitated at first to include it in the form I originally wrote it, just because so much has changed since then. You know, I wrote it, I think, in February of last year. And I think we all, you know, got kind of dizzy, you know, after Trump's victory and thinking that, you know, maybe we really are on the cusp of something here. And then it, you know, unfortunately the whole thing kind of imploded. But, you know, I still think the ideas of the essay are relevant, even if, they're not going to be realized as quickly as maybe we would have hoped. But, I included a new intro, but I basically left the essay more or less the way it was, except for a couple of minor changes. But yeah, hopefully people find it interesting. I basically tried to compare the alt-right with the European new right. Compare and contrast.
Right. Yeah, it's a good piece. I just looked at it the other day again. Some other people who have articles in it are F. Roger Devlin, Wolfie James, who has a piece on A Place for Women in the Alt-Right, Patrick LeBrun, Michael Bell, both popular writers at Countercurrents. There's a section on sexual politics in the alt-right, men going their own way, that kind of stuff. There are a couple pieces by Spencer Quinn, a couple pieces by Donald Thorson that are really quite excellent. We deal with the alt-right and the alt-light, the alt-right and the old right, the alt-right and the new right, and things like that. It's very comprehensive. A lot of these pieces are sort of time capsule pieces. They bear the marks of the time in which they were written, but all of them have something of perennial importance. And there's a whole spate of books out about the alt-right by people who are very, very unsympathetic. And a lot of these books can't even be bothered with getting names and dates correct. They're riddled with elementary errors. Whereas this volume is written by people who are close enough to the phenomenon to get all the facts straight, and yet there's a certain critical distance as well. So there is a space for controversy which is really at the heart and part of the lifeblood of this movement, what the alt-right was and what the broader white nationalist and dissident right movement is still today. So I think it's going to be a very exciting and stimulating collection, and I think it's going to be something of a reference book, a landmark type book that people are going to want to read and look at again and again to try and get sort of definitive statements about elements of this phenomenon from accurate, sympathetic, but not uncritical observers.
Yeah, I think that's very important.
Yeah. And I'm very, very much looking forward to getting this out there. So, John, we've been going for about an hour, and I don't want to basically challenge anybody's attention span. And you've got to get to bed. I know it's fairly late for you in Europe. So are there any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Nothing comes to mind. We're just plugging away and... Yeah, we've got a lot of exciting things on the horizon here.
Yeah, lots of exciting books and more exciting trips and interviews and speeches are coming up. So thank you all for joining us for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.